This episode contains strong language, mentions of disordered eating, and descriptions of drug use.
There's also at least one trashed hotel room. Please be advised.
It's December 1986 in Sydney, Australia. Elton John is at the Sydney Entertainment Center doing a concert with the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra. He's dressed in a black sequin coat with tails and silver stars and a red wig he describes as Tina Turner on an acid trip. The orchestra's playing the opening overture, but Elton isn't headed toward the stage. He's running for the exit like the building's on fire. Elton's in the middle of a mix between a diva tantrum and a panic attack. This is the last show of a long tour, and he's physically exhausted. But more than that, he's been having problems with his voice. Serious problems for months now. He never knows from song to song or note to note what kind of sound he'll make. Sometimes his voice is fine and normal. Sometimes it's raspy and croaky. Sometimes in the middle of a song, he'll open his mouth and no sound will come out at all.
Okay, that's terrifying for a singer.
Yes, he's scared. And deep down, he feels like maybe he has it coming. After all his self-indulgence and reckless living, maybe the check is finally coming due. His doctor advised him to stop the tour completely, but Elton was determined to finish this final leg. He's set to have surgery later this week to remove several cysts for a biopsy to determine if he has cancer. Elton feels doomed either way. Tonight's show is being broadcast live on TV and recorded for an album. It's all just too much. So Elton decides the best way to cope is to leave the building. With the exit sign in sight, he runs past another famous face on his way out, Phil Collins. He's just there to see the show like any other Elton John fan. "Oh, hello, Elton," Phil says. "Wait, hang on, where are you going?" Without stopping or even looking back, Elton shouts, "Home!" But he doesn't go home. He gets as far as the parking lot and stops. If he does have cancer, then he might lose his voice forever. This might be his last chance to perform. So he's gonna give it everything he has left while he still can. Elton turns around and marches right back into the arena.
You gotta admire the tenacity.
That's something I'll never have. The night ends up being the best show of the entire tour. Elton sings "Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me," the song he hated when he originally recorded it. He performs the track like it's the last time he'll ever sing it, because it might be. It all depends on how the surgery goes and what the biopsy turns up. A few days later, after the surgery, Elton's doctor tells him that his cysts are benign. He doesn't have cancer after all. And while he still has his singing voice, it's different than before. The surgery changed his voice, but Elton loves the way it sounds now. He doesn't have the high notes he did before, but he feels like his new sound is richer, more powerful, and more mature. He's dodged another bullet and come out smelling like a rose. He can't believe his luck. Once again, Elton's narrowly avoided disaster, and he knows he's been pushing his luck. He's been thinking a lot about fate and fortune recently, and not just because of his health scare. Recently, he made a new friend, a teenage boy in Indiana named Ryan White. In the few months they've been friends, Ryan's become something of a hero to Elton. And Elton doesn't know it yet, but this friendship is about to change his life. From Wondery, I'm Brooke Ziffrin.
And I'm Arisha Skidmore-Williams.
And this is Even the Rich. In our last episode, Elton came out as bisexual in Rolling Stone magazine and discovered that he really likes cocaine. But no matter how much he lost himself in his vices, Elton couldn't outrun the loneliness and insecurity he felt as a boy. Now, a painful death leads him to his rock bottom. But can he accept the help he needs to make a comeback? This is episode 3, Someone Saved My Life Tonight. It's October 1986 in Anaheim, California, and Elton John is sober. At least for the day. He's at Disneyland with his young friend Ryan White and his mother Jean. They attended Elton's concerts in Oakland 2 nights in a row, and now he's acting as their private Disney tour guide. Elton wants every moment of the White's visit to be perfect, so he skipped the Coke and booze for a few days. He's laser-focused on making this a good trip. And it's paying off. Ryan's smile is a mile wide as he listens to all the fun they have in store. Elton first read about Ryan last year in a Newsweek magazine he picked up in a doctor's office. Ryan is a hemophiliac who contracted HIV through a blood transfusion at 13. A local newspaper found out and ran a story saying Ryan had AIDS. Predictably, all hell broke loose in his blue-collar town of Kokomo. Ryan was kicked out of school by the superintendent. Customers on his paper route canceled their subscriptions. People at his Methodist church refused to shake his hand. His mother's car tires were slashed. And not surprisingly, the adults in the town behaved even worse than the kids.
Yeah, it's where the kids get it.
Exactly. The bigotry Ryan faced infuriates Elton. So when he learned that Ryan was a fan of his music, he reached out to see if there was anything he could do to help. Now, Elton's pushing Ryan around the theme park in his wheelchair while Jean snaps the occasional photo. As they make their way down Main Street, Elton finds himself wanting to complain about something, anything. The heat, the fans, the sugary smell Disney pumps onto the sidewalk to make you want to buy something sweet. Complaining is like a hobby for Elton. But he holds his tongue today. Because in the time he's spent with Ryan and his family, he's never heard them complain about a single thing. And they have lots of valid reasons to be upset. As they enter the haunted mansion, Elton puts his hand on Ryan's shoulder. The hydraulic floor descends and the paintings on the wall stretch and stretch and stretch. Jean giggles, Ryan's eyes get wide, and Elton smiles. Not just because he's doing a good deed for a kid who's having a rough time, but because he's genuinely having fun. In the last few years, disenchantment has become Elton's default setting. But being around the Whites, who are unfailingly gracious and courageous, is making him want to be a better man. He's not quite there yet, but they do make him want to be less of a selfish asshole. When Elton returns to England after his tour, his addictions are right there with him. Cocaine, alcohol, sex, and shopping. But, inspired by Ryan and his family's example, Elton does start to face the uncomfortable things in his life. In the past, when a conflict would come up, his strategy had always been to avoid, deny, or bury himself under a mountain of coke. Maybe, Elton thinks, it'd be better to face conflict head on. And soon enough, he gets his chance. When the tabloid The Sun publishes a lurid, false story about his sex life, implying that he's been with underage boys, Elton decides to sue. No one in his life thinks it's a good idea. Mick Jagger even calls him to say, "Don't sue. They'll come after you even harder like they did to me." Way back in the 1960s, Mick fought back against a false story The Sun printed. The tabloid alleged that he'd bragged about using drugs to an undercover reporter. Jagger did what's called issuing a writ against the paper, which is kind of like suing. The tabloid fought back, and they fought dirty. They started spying on him, tapping his phone, paying informants, and working with police to set up a drug bust at Keith Richards' home. Mick and Keith both ended up in prison on pretty flimsy charges. But the public outcry was so great that their sentences were eventually overturned. Still, it was a total shit show. Mick tells Elton, "Let it go. Don't get into the mud with those pigs. It's not worth it."
Yeah, except pigs like mud.
Very good point. But Mick's warning makes Elton even more angry at what tabloids get away with. He's more determined than ever to strike back. If Ryan White can fight to stay in his school, then Elton can stand up to a sleazy tabloid. But as it turns out, Mick Jagger was right. Things get ugly. Elton ends up at war with the Sun. The fight practically becomes a full-time job for him. The tabloids print even more false stories about him. And each time they do, Elton files another libel writ against them.
This sounds absolutely exhausting.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty brutal time. Some days, Elton feels fired up and full of righteous anger. But on other days, he feels hopeless, regretful, and ashamed. Sure, the stories they're printing are all made up, but Elton's decades of reckless behavior have made him vulnerable. Everyone in the business knows he's addicted to cocaine, and he hasn't always been careful about picking trustworthy partners. Something like this was bound to happen eventually. His resolve bottoms out when the Sun finally gets something on him that isn't fabricated. A decade-old Polaroid of him giving a blowjob.
As if we needed further proof that tabloids are complete trash.
Right, seriously. Whenever the stress of his war with the Sun gets too intense, Elton isolates himself in a room in his mansion, just like he used to hide out in his bedroom as a kid when his parents were fighting. He doesn't eat for days. He sustains himself on booze and drugs. And when he does finally emerge, he stuffs himself with food. This happens often enough that Elton develops an eating disorder. At his lowest points, he consoles himself with two thoughts. One, he's absolutely in the right, morally speaking. They shouldn't be allowed to publish lies with no impunity. And two, there are people in the world who are dealing with far worse, like his friend Ryan White. It's 1987 in Leeds, England, and Elton John is on the set of a talk show called One to One. It's hosted by Michael Parkinson, an interviewer he's had a good rapport with for years. The last thing Elton wants to do right now is be interviewed on TV. First of all, he looks like hell from all the stress.
And the drugs.
Yeah, I mean, especially the drugs. He's pale, unshaven, and wearing a Watford hat so he wouldn't have to style his wig. But the second reason he doesn't want to be here is that he's afraid to say something that will make things with the Sun worse. But when Parkinson called and told him to fight back, Elton decided to trust him. Now he's going to tell his side of the story in a public way.
It has been the worst 5 months I've ever had to endure, but it can only get better. I can't get any worse. And it's made me more determined to fight what I've had to want to fight with all the press things. Mm-hmm. I'm absolutely determined to see this one out.
Later in the interview, Elton reveals that the tabloids tried to bribe the receptionist at his doctor's office to get his wife's medical records. The studio audience groans at the revelation. Elton realizes they're on his side, so he hammers his point home with his trademark wit.
They probably want to examine my sperm or something like that. God forbid. Well, according to the Sun, they must have packetfuls of it.
Appealing directly to the public works. Their positive response gives Elton the strength to keep fighting. Finally, after 17 stories and 17 writs, his case gets a trial date. And the day before the trial, the Sun finally caves. They offer to settle for £1 million, the largest libel settlement in British history at the time. Elton accepts. As part of the settlement, the Sun is forced to issue an apology in as large a typeface as the original article. A banner headline across the front page reads, "Sorry, Elton." Elton makes sure to be at a newsstand when the first editions of the paper arrive in the wee hours of the morning. He needs to see it to believe it. After his showdown with the Sun, Elton takes another big, difficult step. He finally confronts another situation that just isn't working. In 1988, he and Renata divorce after 4 years. Renata's lived up to her end of the deal. She's loved him unconditionally. But now he's hurting her. There's a reason he's lived with avoidance for so long. He hates breaking her heart, but he knows it's the right thing to do. It's the summer of 1988, and Elton is leading a trio from Sotheby's through his Woodside residence. They're here in preparation for an upcoming auction. But it's so packed in here, there's hardly an inch of free space. Elton has always liked shopping and collecting, but lately he's been feeling overwhelmed by all the things surrounding him. He's run out of room in his four-story mansion. Even his squash court is unusable because it's completely filled by all the storage crates that can't fit in the house.
So squash courts are just rich people versions of hall closets.
Yeah, but they don't record their podcasts there. Sotheby's is more than happy to help, but even their experts are a little shell-shocked. Elton's not sure if it's because of the sheer amount of stuff he has or because of how tacky some of it is. Sure, there's Tiffany stained glass, Carlo Bugatti furniture, and Magritte paintings, but there's also a pair of brass bath taps with plexiglass testicles, and I thought I was the only one who had those. A Sotheby's rep asks about a life-size sculpture of a gorilla in an Edwardian dress, and Elton explains, "Oh, a fan made me that. It represents the futility of war." In the end, it takes Sotheby's 3 days just to transport everything to their warehouses. The exhibition held before the auction fills the entire Victoria and Albert Museum, and it's still only showing a quarter of what's for sale. They hold 4 separate auctions to get through it all, but it's a huge success. Even the gorilla sells. Feeling 1 million pounds lighter, Elton commissions a total makeover of his Woodside estate.
I should get Sotheby's to come over here and sell my Harry Potter dolls.
Yeah, you really should. And Elton has the place totally gutted so he can start fresh. It feels very adult, but his childish side is still there. And sometimes it rages. It's late 1988. And Elton's staying at the very posh inn at the Park Hotel in London. He's here while his home is being renovated. It's 11 a.m., and Elton is furious. He can't sleep, and he's sure it's because the wind outside his window is so loud, not because he's been getting high all night. He picks up the phone and dials Robert Key, one of the heads of his record company. "Robert, you've got to do something about the wind outside my hotel room."
Okay, Miranda Priestly, calm down.
Yeah, he's belligerent. Robert, who's used to fielding Elton's unreasonable requests, simply says,
"As powerful as I am, I cannot control the weather. Why don't you just change rooms?"
Elton spits back, "I can't have them barging in here. There are drugs all over the place." After a beat, Elton hears Robert announce to the rest of the office,
"Oh, God. She's finally lost it."
Elton's arrested development is getting old. And not just to the people around him. Elton's getting pretty sick of himself, too. Especially as his young friend Ryan White fights for his life. Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank?
Literally always.
Okay, well, the new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look, and it comes in luxe gold packaging. It feels incredibly high-end, but it is a lot more affordable.
Oh yeah, the Panorama Mascara lives up to its name by giving your lashes panoramic volume and a fully fanned-out look. Its tapered mascara wand catches every single lash, including those hard-to-reach corner lashes. When I do wear makeup, I do the bare minimum, and that's usually eyeliner and mascara and lip gloss. And So mascara has to really pop.
Yes.
And let me tell you, L'Oreal, this baby pops.
Yeah. I do love the packaging. Like, I'm all about that.
So if you're looking for an affordable mascara that gives you voluminous, lengthened lashes, you can buy the Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
So as a listener of Even the Rich, you know that audio piques the imagination, which is why we're so excited for Audible's new collection of exclusive thrillers. They feature captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances that really bring the story to life.
Oh, yeah. The next listen on my list is the psychological thriller, The Silent Patient.
Ooh.
So it's all about a therapist who tries to unravel the mystery of a woman who refuses to talk
or give any explanation as to why she shot her husband. I mean, it's going to be the perfect binge listen, and you know I love my thrillers.
I can agree. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog.
Yeah, new members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/eventherich or text eventherich to 500-500.
That's audible.com/eventherich or text eventherich to 500-500 to get started. It's the spring of 1990, and Elton is in Atlanta, Georgia. His new lover, an American named Hugh Williams, lives here. Elton met Hugh while touring the States in support of his latest album, Sleeping with the Past. The tour was pretty fraught. There were drug binges, fights with his record company, and multiple show and interview cancellations. He even collapsed on stage during one concert. So now he's glad to be in Atlanta with Hugh, where they can bask in their love affair and do drugs together in peace. Elton's in bed sleeping off his latest binge when the phone rings. It's Jean White, Ryan's mother.
"I'm so sorry to bother you," she says. "But it's Ryan. They just rushed him to the hospital with a severe respiratory infection. He's on life support."
Suddenly, Elton feels like the whole room is spinning. He's not sure if it's the drugs or the bad news, but he knows what he's got to do next. He's got to get himself on a flight. Elton John is in Indianapolis, Indiana. He's walking down the hallway of the Riley Hospital for Children, dressed plainly in a black blazer and matching ball cap. He's carrying a bag with a sandwich and chips in one hand and a pint of Haagen-Dazs in the other. Ryan White is in the final stages of his fight with AIDS, and Elton is here to do whatever he can to help. Often, that means acting as the White's receptionist, answering the telegrams and phone calls coming in from around the world. Right now, it means making a cafeteria run for Ryan's mother, Jean. When Elton first arrived from Atlanta a few days ago, there was commotion in the hospital. After all, there was a global rock icon walking through the halls. But the stardust in everyone's eyes faded fairly quickly. Now, Elton's just like all the adults, doing whatever he can to help these kids feel a little bit better. The next day, that means decorating Ryan's room with balloons, stuffed animals, and pictures of things he knows Ryan likes. He's standing on a chair taping multicolored streamers over the sterile gray window shade when Jean returns from a walk outside. Jean smiles. She's touched. It's perfect, and it's something that she hadn't even thought to do. "You're like our guardian angel," Jean says, looking down at her sleeping son. "I think it's actually the reverse," Elton says. He steps off the chair and zhuzhes the streamers so they hang just so. "When he wakes up, I want him to know how much he's loved." Jean tells Elton he's like family to her, and his heart swells. He wants to be in this family. Their love is unconditional. The love in his family always felt conditional, and he was never sure what the conditions even were. He still isn't sure. Being here while Ryan clings to life is painful. But Elton, he wouldn't want to be anywhere else. Ryan stirs from his sleep, sees that Elton is still there, and smiles. Jean tells Ryan there's someone who wants to talk to him. She dials a number written on a piece of paper, greets the person on the other end, then hands the receiver to Elton. He holds it to Ryan's ear. A voice, high, faint, and familiar, comes out of the receiver.
"Ryan, it's Michael."
For the next several minutes, Ryan listens as Michael Jackson offers him words of love and comfort. Ryan's too weak to carry on a conversation, but he can hear Michael just fine. Elton and Michael are close friends, but it's not lost on him how surreal the situation is. For two decades, the superstar artists have competed on the Billboard charts. But now, Elton and Michael both want the same thing. For Ryan to know how loved he is, and that he doesn't need to be afraid.
"Okay, we should have said bring Kleenex during the disclaimer at the top."
I know, it's so sad. And a few days later, Ryan dies at the age of 18, 1 month before his high school graduation. Elton stays in Indiana to support Gene and performs his song Skyline Pigeon at Ryan's memorial service. It's one of the first records he recorded with Bernie Taupin as his co-writer. Its themes of freedom and transcendence remind him of Ryan. After the service, Elton is by Gene's side when some of the same people who tormented the family now offer her their condolences. Without even a moment's hesitation, Gene forgives them. Later that night in his hotel room, a tidal wave of conflicting emotions crashes over Elton. He's grief-stricken, but he's also grateful that he got to spend time with Ryan and his family. Mostly, though, he's angry. Not at the ignorant people who tormented the whites or the Reagan administration for failing to take AIDS seriously. He's not even angry at God for taking an innocent boy too soon. He's angry at himself. As he lies back in bed, the full gravity of his selfishness descends on Elton like a fog. He's the biggest gay rock star in the world. But what has he done to fight AIDS and homophobia? Not a lot. Sure, he's had ornate plaques made for all the people he'd lost to AIDS, and there are so many. John Reed's assistant, Neil, was the first person he knew who died. 3 weeks after being diagnosed, he was gone. After that, it was like an avalanche. Friends, acquaintances, work colleagues, multiple exes of Elton's have died, including a young man named Vance Buck, who inspired the song Blue Eyes. AIDS feels like the killer in a horror movie. Merciless, indestructible, and you never know where it's going to strike next. Elton's terrified of it too, and now he wants to do more. There have been benefit concerts and charity singles. One was even hugely successful. That's What Friends Are For, a song he recorded with Gladys Knight, Dionne Warwick, and Stevie Wonder, became the number one single of 1986, won Song of the Year at the Grammys, and raised $3 million for AIDS research and prevention.
Not bad for a few hours in the studio.
But that kind of show-busy activism feels shallow and superficial to Elton now. He should be on the front lines, marching in the streets with activist groups like ACT UP, or helping to start a research foundation like Elizabeth Taylor with AMFAR. The shame he feels makes him sick to his stomach. Elton flips on the TV. CNN is airing coverage from Ryan's memorial. He watches as Michael Jackson arrives, then First Lady Barbara Bush. Then he sees footage of himself, first singing at the piano, then later by the open casket, where he placed his hands on Ryan's face and told him he loved him. Elton watches the footage in shock. He simply can't believe how horrible he looks on TV. He's bloated. His skin is as gray as clay. His hair is white. He's 43 years old, but he looks like he's 70. Watching Ryan die up close clarified for Elton how much he wants to live. He knows something has to change. He has to change. But when he returns to his life as a rock star, things get even worse. The wake-up calls keep coming, but Elton just keeps hitting the snooze button. And he starts being irresponsible in ways he never has before. For example, Elton's always had a no drugs before a gig policy. After the show, all bets are off. He had a man in his entourage whose only job was to roll his joints.
Okay, that might not be that uncommon because Snoop Dogg just gave a raise to his joint roller.
What a dream job.
Yeah.
Usually, there were lines of coke cut and waiting for him when he left the stage. But he'd always believed that indulging before a show was letting his fans down. Now he's getting high before shows and messing up on stage. Even when he's playing a benefit for the Ryan White Foundation, with Ryan's mother Jean White in the audience.
Oof.
Yeah. But even while he's getting sloppy on stage, Elton scores a huge career win. Back in the UK, his song Sacrifice is blowing up. A British DJ named Steve Wright likes the song and puts it in heavy rotation. 3 weeks later, Elton has his first solo number one single in the UK.
I love that song and loving it even more with the Dua Lipa remix.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that song is the gift that definitely keeps on giving. In 1990, it stays at number one for 5 weeks in the UK. But back in Atlanta, his luck may finally be running out. The drugging and drinking has become untenable for his boyfriend, Hugh. He tells Elton he doesn't want to drink or use drugs anymore, but he doesn't think he can stop on his own. He needs help. So he's heading to rehab and he's leaving that day. You'd think that with Elton's epiphany in Indianapolis, he'd be supportive of Hugh, maybe even pack a bag and go to rehab with him. But that's not what happens. Elton goes ballistic on Hugh. He says cruel things designed for maximum hurtfulness. Hugh isn't just his current lover. He's also his number one drug buddy. And if Hugh thinks he's an addict, then he's basically accusing Elton of being an addict too. But he still can't admit the truth to himself. Nearly everyone in his life, from his former valet to famous friends like Freddie Mercury, have told him he needs to give it a rest with the coke. At one of his raging Hollywood parties, he mistook music legend Bob Dylan for his gardener.
Okay, I can't get upset about this because I don't know what his gardener looks like.
Fair, but Elton was high out of his mind at a party. He saw a shabbily dressed man at the bar and loudly confronted him, demanding to know why his gardener was crashing his party and helping himself to drinks. His poor assistant Bob had to intervene, like, "Elton, that's not the gardener, it's Bob Dylan."
And then he was like, "Elton, how many Bobs do you see?"
Exactly. So to make it up to Bob, Elton tries to drag him upstairs and dress him in something from his closet. He pulls on Bob's arm and tells him that he has plenty of clothes that Bob can wear.
And Bob's like, thanks, but I really just wanted that orange soda I was getting before you screamed at me.
Right. Finally, a voice across the room says, "Elton, you need to go steady on the old marching powder." It's George Harrison, who's witnessed the whole thing.
If you're at the point where one of the Beatles is telling you to lay off the coke, maybe it's time to lay off the coke.
Yeah, but Elton doesn't listen. And now he's refusing to listen to Hugh, the man he claims to love. He lashes out with every cruel put-down he can come up with. But it doesn't change Hugh's mind. He leaves for rehab that day. Elton is utterly alone. Again. And he's more lost than ever.
Life is busier than ever. It might be harder to find time these days to grocery shop, prep, and cook healthy and hearty meals. I get it. But Factor's got you covered.
Yeah, so Factor's fresh, never frozen meals are chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, delivered right to your door, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes.
Exactly. And Factor is tailored to your schedule. You can customize your weekly meals with the flexibility to get as much or as little as you need. If you're traveling or still finishing up last week's meals, you can always pause or reschedule deliveries.
I mean, I know I've talked before about how much I love Factor because it's just so easy.
And it doesn't taste like, you know, the microwavable meals you see, especially in rom-coms when we're trying to heighten and highlight how sad and pathetic this woman's life is.
Yeah.
They don't taste like that. They taste so good as if you made them yourself or hired a chef. Head to factormeals.com/rich50 and use code rich50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next box. That's code rich50 at factormeals.com/rich50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
We all face stress in our daily lives. What if the answer to a better stress response is in one key nutrient? I'm talking about magnesium, and specifically Magnesium Breakthrough by Optimizers. This one-of-a-kind product is designed to reverse low levels of magnesium, which could have a positive effect on our stress response. But don't take my word for it. Here's a quote from a 2020 issue of the scientific journal Nutrients. Results suggest that stress could increase magnesium loss, causing a deficiency. And in turn, magnesium deficiency could enhance the body's susceptibility to stress, resulting in a magnesium and stress vicious circle. I only recommend Magnesium Breakthrough by Bioptimizers. It's the only organic full-spectrum magnesium supplement that includes 7 unique forms of magnesium for stress resilience and better sleep. Simply go to bioptimizers.com/ifstories, promo code ifstories10 to get your Magnesium Breakthrough and find out this month's gift with purchase. That's bioptimizers.com/ifstories, promo code ifstories10.
It's a few weeks after Hugh has left for rehab, and Elton is walking through the lobby of the Sierra Tucson Rehab facility in Arizona. The Hotel Bel Air, this is not. But it's a pleasant enough environment with its Pueblo-style decor and tranquil desert landscaping. The whole place seems designed to be soothing. But Elton's not buying what they're selling. He's not there to get help for himself. He still doesn't think he needs it. He's here, quite reluctantly, to see Hugh, as part of Hugh's treatment. And although Elton is walking in of his own volition, in his mind, Hugh and these so-called professionals are dragging him there, kicking and screaming. But mere minutes into his meeting with Hugh and his counselors, Elton feels his blood start to boil. The main counselor thanks him for coming all this way. But before he can even broach a real conversation, Elton's out of his chair ranting. He tells Hugh he needs to leave the facility and come back home with him. Hugh, this place is a total shithole, and these counselors are a bunch of creeps.
Okay, someone should get security.
Yeah, they should. But Hugh doesn't even budge from his chair, even as Elton screams at him about how the staff is trying to brainwash him. Elton is promptly escorted from the property. He drives straight to the airport and flies back to London. There, he copes with his feelings the same way he always has. He retreats to his bedroom and locks the door. This time, though, it might be forever. It's June of 1990, and Elton John is holed up in a bedroom in his rented home in London. He's been here for several days. Around him sit empty whiskey bottles, Coke mirrors, half-eaten sandwiches, and lists. Lots and lots of lists. Elton has decided it's his job to make them. Lists of albums he owns, lists of artists he'd like to work with, lists of football teams he admires. The lists are why he needs to stay awake taking more drugs. He needs to finish the lists.
I mean, I love my lists, but this seems excessive.
Yeah, remember the one you wrote about how much you love me and all the things you love about me?
Nope.
Okay.
Doesn't exist.
Okay. Well, you're right, it is excessive. And when he runs out of list ideas, he snorts more Coke, drinks more whiskey, and masturbates in a designer dressing gown that's covered in his own puke.
Oh, that's too many bodily fluids for me, dog.
Yeah. The pathetic scene he caused at Hugh's rehab facility makes Elton feel even worse about the tsunami of shame he felt after Ryan White's funeral. Now he's crumbling into himself. The phone rings and he doesn't answer it. His housekeeper knocks to check on him, but he's so paranoid and afraid that he assumes she's some kind of spy. Maybe she's from The Sun trying to get pictures of Elton at rock bottom. Right now, Elton feels alone. But Peter Gabriel and Kate Bush are in the room with him. Not in person, of course. He's listening to their song Don't Give Up on repeat and sobbing. Their lyrics seem tailor-made for his situation. I am a man whose dreams have all deserted. I've changed my face. I've changed my name. But no one wants you when you lose. Elton rocks back and forth on the floor, racked with a self-hatred that makes his whole body ache. He thinks of Ryan constantly. He knows how hurt and disappointed he would be if he saw him like this. Elton hates his life. He hates what he's become. And he doesn't think he can go on like this for one more day. But through his despair, he hears Peter and Kate sing, "Don't give up. You're not beaten yet." Elton doesn't want to give up, but he feels too broken to continue and too proud to ask for help. And he's still reeling from breaking up with Hugh. One minute, he's throwing pillows across the room and cursing Hugh's name. The next, he's desperate to talk to him. He picks up the phone and calls the Sierra Tucson Rehab Facility. A counselor tells Elton that Hugh's already checked out. He's completed his treatment. Desperate to find him, Elton asks where Hugh is now. But the counselor tells him that Hugh gave them specific instructions not to tell Elton his whereabouts.
Can't blame him.
Mm-hmm. Elton curses in frustration and slams the phone down. In a Hail Mary pass, he calls an ex of Hugh's in the States. The ex tells him that Hugh is in a halfway house a few hours away from the rehab facility in Arizona. Elton's fingers tremble as he dials the facility. When Hugh comes on the line, Elton begins to cry. Through his tears, he tells Hugh that he needs to see him. There's a pause on the other end of the line, but then Hugh agrees. Elton's body collapses in relief, and he smiles for the first time in months. But Hugh stresses that he has some conditions. Elton looks around at his luxurious squalor, his pitiful five-star drug den, and responds, "Name them." A few days later, Elton is walking through a hotel lobby in Prescott, Arizona. Boisterous families of tourists gather in groups, excited to set off for Sedona or the Grand Canyon. Elton's energy is the polar opposite. He suspects he's about to walk into some kind of intervention attempt. It feels like he's walking to his doom. But he reminds himself, no, his doom was back in that bedroom in London. He arrives at the designated room on the third floor and knocks. Hugh isn't staying here, nor is Elton. It's a neutral place. That's the idea anyway. Still, Elton can't help but feel like his underdog Watford team. A moment later, the door opens, and there's Hugh. Physically, he looks much healthier than the last time Elton saw him. He's clear-eyed and sun-kissed. But he also looks absolutely terrified as he invites Elton inside. Elton is only a little surprised to find two counselors from Hugh's rehab in the room with him. One of them takes over. "Okay, here's what's going to happen," he starts. He's using a tone that says, "Don't even think about pulling any diva shenanigans today, bitch." He tells Elton that he and Hugh will sit in chairs facing each other and look each other in the eye. Elton and Hugh sit in the chairs, practically touching. The other counselor takes the floor. One of the conditions for the meeting was that Elton had to complete some homework. He had to make a list.
Well, he's definitely got practice with that.
Yeah, Elton was like, "Ooh, yay." Elton and Hugh were both told to write a list of three things that they don't like about the other person. The counselor asks Elton if he brought his with him. He pulls a piece of paper from his jacket pocket. The counselor asks him to read it to Hugh. Elton looks apologetically into Hugh's eyes and begins to read. "Hugh is untidy. He doesn't put the CDs back in that case when he's done with them."
Kind of feels like he's grasping at straws here.
Yeah, he's masturbating in puke, so. But these are apparently Elton's biggest gripes. He does add one other pretty serious infraction. Hugh leaves the lights on when he exits a room.
Oh my God, Hugh is such a monster.
Seriously. Elton folds up his list and puts it in his pocket. The counselor turns to Hugh and tells him it's his turn. Hugh pulls a piece of paper from his pocket and looks down at it and braces himself. Elton can see that Hugh's written a whole page. Hugh looks from the paper up to his counselor, who nods encouragingly. "You're a drug addict. You're an alcoholic. You're a food addict, you're bulimic, you're a sex addict, and you're codependent." Elton sits in silence and just listens. Part of him wants to scream that this is bullshit and storm out. But Elton's out of options, and he knows it. He's shaking as much as Hugh is. But he tells himself he's gotta stay and listen. He's gotta hear the truth. Hugh finally gets to the bottom of his page. He stares right at Elton as he says the last five words. "You need to get help." Hugh puts his paper back in his pocket. No one speaks right away. All eyes are on Elton. He knows that this moment in this hotel room in Prescott, Arizona, will determine the course of the rest of his life. Through tears, he finally responds. You're right. I'll go somewhere. I'll get help. For years, Elton believed that if he admitted he needed help, it would diminish him somehow. But that's not what happens. Instead of fear and shame, he feels relief. It's like a small fire gets lit inside him, and he's certain his friend Ryan struck the match. He begins exploring rehab facilities that afternoon.
And puts them on a list, I hope.
Of course. But Elton struggles to find one that suits him. None of the fancy celebrity facilities will treat all of his addictions at once. Some do drugs and alcohol, but they don't do food addictions. Or they do, but they want to tackle one vice at a time. But Elton wants to deal with them all together. He's sure they're all connected to the same thing. The unresolved pain from his pre-fame life as Reginald Dwight. In late July of 1990, Elton checks into Parkside Lutheran Hospital in Chicago. It's the one place that can treat all his addictions. Elton knows it's this or death. But he soon discovers that asking for help is one thing. Accepting help is another beast entirely.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Even the Rich ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
This is episode 3 of our 4-part series, Elton John Still Standing. We use many sources when researching our stories, including Elton John, The Biography by David Buckley, and Captain Fantastic, The Definitive Guide to Elton John in the 70s by David DeCuoto. But we especially recommend Elton John's autobiography, Me. A quick note about our scenes. Some scripted dialogue has been added for narrative cohesiveness. I'm Brooke Ziffrin.
And I'm Arisha Skidmore-Williams. Dennis Hensley wrote this episode. Editing is by Julia Wolf. Our audio engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Sound design is by Chris Martin. Our coordinating producer is Matt Gant. Our managing producer is Tanja Thigpen. Kate Young is our series producer. Our executive producers are Stephanie Jens, Jenny Lauer-Beckman, and Marshall Louie for Wondery.
Once upon a beat. Remember the stories and fables that captured your imagination when you were young? We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remixed and reimagined for the kids in your life today. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a music-filled weekly party hosted by me, DJ Fuse, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, spinning tales in the New Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat, where hip-hop and fables meet. Hey, grown-ups, listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. Once Upon a Beat.